So last night, Max began the talk, the discussion about the fourth foundation of mindfulness, which, as he said, is the dhammas or dharmas, and he referred to them as the truths. And this is the foundation of mindfulness where wisdom comes into play, where there's a real different kind of understanding. For the most part, the greatest part, in the earlier foundations, the task is mostly just to see what's there, to understand, to recognize. When there's a feeling, there's a feeling. When there's you're breathing, that you're breathing. When you're walking, that you're walking. When there's a mind state, there's a mind state. And I hope you begin to get some intimation of how powerful and significant it is to the very simple act of knowing. In the fourth foundation, it's more than just knowing what's present. But it's also beginning to understand the causality, the causal world in which our experiences occur in. And in particular, the central insight of the Buddha that appears in a variety of ways, but really the central insight is insight into the dependent origination, which takes a very simple form and is expressed almost directly in the Four Noble Truths. And this is that something exists, something occurs, it has a cause or has an origin, something that gives rise to it, and then it has a cessation, it has something, has something that changes it as it goes away, brings it to an end. And then there's a way to do that. There's a process either to have it go, or if it's something beneficial, have it stay and have it maintained. So this is understanding kind of the causal world in which something is in, because we don't want to simply only go around. Good Buddhists, only you're allowed to do is to know things as they are, as if just knowing, seeing things. But we want to begin understanding the causal world in which we're living in, so that we can step into it. And not be knowingly just swept along in the world as it is. You know, boy, those Buddhists, they just get swept along, and they really know they're swept along. You know, they're swept along in their suffering, and they just know they suffer. Suffering, and you know, Buddhists know how to suffer better because they know how to be present and mindful and allowing and accepting, and that's it, right? If that's it, you know, I would probably take up stamp collecting or something. Do something different. But we're supposed to step into that stream of change, a stream of causality, and make a difference. And make a difference in one particular way. Make a difference to bring our suffering to an end. And there was in the time of the Buddha, there was a man who had been a monk of the Buddha, and disrobed in displeasure in the Buddha's teachings, but in the Buddha had to say. And then he went around town disparaging the Buddha. And he disparaged him by saying, all the Buddha teaches is the end of suffering. And nothing better, nothing higher. No lofty, you know, lofty attainments and stuff, just the end of suffering. And this came back to the Buddha, and he said, he called him a foolish man. He said, this foolish man, he thinks he's disparaging me, but actually he's praising me. Because what could be loftier, what could be more meaningful than the end of suffering? It's a profound thing to end it. So what are the forces that keep us bound in the world of suffering, and what are the forces that help free us of it? So last night Max talked about the hindrances, which is, hindrances are some of the forces of the mind that keep us locked in, keep us caught up in activities of the mind which involve, can keep us suffering. A hindrance is something that we're caught up in, that distorts our perceptions, distorts our relationship to the world around us. Sensual desire, as Max said, can be a hindrance. It doesn't have to be a hindrance. Sensual desire is a hindrance when we're caught up in it, when we're attached in it, when it colors our image, it colors our perception. And it's possible to have sensual desire, and, you know, for some of us, desires are like a dime a dozen. And they're easy to have, and it's easy to let go. They come and they go. It doesn't have to carry any weight or have any authority over us to have a desire. Things float through, and it's possible. Just float through, and it's innocent enough. Desires are innocent. You're not. Because we latch onto it, we get involved. And so the idea is to begin understanding the nature of these hindrances, and as Max mentioned, is to understand not only that they're there, but to understand how they come to be, what they arise out of, and how they're abandoned, how they can be let go of, and how once they're let go of, how you can keep them from reappearing again. So this is the wisdom, to understand something about them. So this is more than just being present. And so now the end of the last exercise, the last approach of the fourth foundation is the Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths have a lot to do about what helps to free us, the insights that help to liberate us. And they follow kind of the same pattern. Something exists, this is what gives it rise to it, this is the cessation of it, and this is the way to bring the cessation of it. So this, the core insight of dependent origination now is being directed towards suffering. Suffering exists, or when suffering exists, it has a cause, it has something it arises out of, an origin, a source. And if you let go of that origin or that cause, the suffering ceases. And there's a path to walk in order to bring that to an end. So here again, it's seeing the causal world which things are in. It doesn't mean you do a lot of analysis and figuring out, but as the mind gets concentrated and quiet and mindful, we start seeing how the magic trick is done. We start seeing how we latch on or get caught or identify with things or create an identity, hold on to it. And as we see what we do, then the magic trick loses its power over us. And I use that analogy because some of you might have had the experience of watching a magician do a magic trick. And as long as you don't know how the trick is done, it's mesmerizing, it's fascinating, and you can watch it for a long time. But as soon as you know how the trick is done, it's not so interesting anymore. You're not going to watch it very much longer. So is there, what's the trick that keeps us, gets us hooked in so that we suffer? It's part of what we discover here. So the Four Noble Truths, we bring it with his last topic for this retreat. It's the last topic of the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. It's sometimes people have complained a little bit that the Four Noble Truths are kind of like kindergarten Buddhism. We should really get onto the real important things because it's so simple, right? Suffering, cause, the end. Everyone understands that. But what I think was really beautiful about the Four Noble Truths is that they're relevant at any stage of life, any stage of our practice, in any situation. If we're beginners in practice, they're relevant. If we're middling in our practice, they're relevant. If we're advanced in our practice, they're relevant. They're relevant any time that we practice. And they are a tremendous protection to us. If we can rely on the Four Noble Truths, if we use them as perspective, as a reference point to understand our experience, they are a great protection. And so, for example, the idea is to pay attention to suffering when it occurs, to stress, to tension, not to overlook it, not to ignore it, but to let suffering be your teacher. Someone at IMC published a whole bunch of bumper stickers and to put in our counter there, and eventually disappeared. I haven't seen them in any cars, but the bumper sticker says, I break for suffering. He's a Buddhist, that's, you know, I break for suffering. Because, you know, that's the idea, is you stop in a wise way, it's not always, but you have to have some wisdom to know when. But the idea is you pay attention to suffering. And then you try to understand what's going on with the suffering, what causes it, what's happening, in particular, what we do as the Buddhist path. There's many things we can say are the cause of my suffering, but the only place you'll find the path of Buddhism, if you want the path to liberation, is if you turn your attention to your contribution to the suffering. There might be all kinds of people contributing to your suffering. If you want to find the path to liberation, it's not very interesting. If you want to take care of it in real life terms, you might have to go talk to people or do something in the world, absolutely. But that's not where you find the path to liberation. You find it in taking responsibility for your contribution to the suffering. So the Four Noble Truths then is to turn, second step is to turn and understand what is it that what's the cause of the suffering. And then partly the Buddha gives us a hint by saying that it's a craving, some kind of drivenness, some kind of compulsion that the mind lives under. I like the word compulsion and drivenness for the Second Noble Truth, because that's why we suffer. We can't put it down. We're pushed around by it. We're in the grip of it. If we weren't in the grip of it, if it was, you know, desires are dime a dozen, I'll take it or leave it, then, you know, you won't suffer. Just don't. It's okay. Let that go. So a certain drivenness or compulsion or caught in the grip of. And then we can learn to let go of that grip. So in the beginning of practice, when a person first begins, maybe say something like meditation practice, then as a person learns about Buddhism, there could be all kinds of reasons they could suffer. They could suffer because they hear about some lofty, great attainment. And they say, why could I get that? And so they suffer because they have this expectation that now I'm going to strive and push. So we stop for suffering. So we feel the tension and the pressure of that. Well, what's that coming from? You feel this in the grip of craving, of wanting an experience. And then we let go of it. And in that letting go, we're protected. And that movement is good at any point along the stage of practice. Some people might protest and say, well, but there's all these important things to attain and get and do in practice. And I'll let go eventually. Give me chastity, but not yet. Give me letting go, but not yet. Eventually. But I think you do it all along. And as I said the other evening, I think it's really helpful to consider that the goal of practice should be reflected in the means. That we don't want to do a means, an approach to practice that runs counter to where we're trying to go. So if we're trying to go is to freedom from clinging, it doesn't really work to cling along the path to ending clinging. So the Four Noble Truths are the protection from that. So keep tuning in. And in fact, in some of the deeper stages of meditation, where conventionally there's no suffering at all, the Four Noble Truths are still relevant, but then instead of suffering, it's called stress or pressure or tension. So a very teeny bit left. Even there you can. And so we train ourselves to be sensitive to this process. Now the Four Noble Truths are really ordinary phenomena. When we call them the Four Noble Truths, you know, noble is like pretty lofty and sounds kind of religious, and you know, we say it's the central teaching of Buddhism, and wow, that's pretty important. It's part of I don't know if I like this religion stuff. You know, it's part of a religion, and you know, who knows what kind of hocus pocus they're going to tell us now with Four Noble Truths and religion. But they're really ordinary. And in fact, I would suggest that each of you is already, before you heard about Buddhism at all, and lots of people all over the world, without even knowing about the Four Noble Truths, are practicing them. It's a really ordinary, normal thing to do. You're standing in line at the supermarket, and you're standing in the wrong line, and you feel your impatience, and you realize that, you know, your tension and patience you feel, you can't really, it doesn't really make sense to blame the line or the clerk, even though the clerk is going really slow. The clerk is not responsible for your tension. Only you can be responsible for that. And so you say, well, I'm here, nothing I can do, so I'll let go. Just be here. Or maybe make even maybe more ordinary, maybe, and it's ordinary, I don't know what people do, but I do this sometimes. You know, you're driving down the street happily and the light is green. Before you can get to the intersection, it turns red. And so I'm standing there and impatient. You know, I have important places to do, important people to talk to, important dharma to teach. I got to teach people to let go, you know. And so, you know, I could feel this kind of like this, you know, raring to go kind of feeling, which is maybe not conventional. You know, usually we think of as suffering, but there's pressure, there's stress, there's tension there. Now, who am I going to blame now? There's no store clerk even, right? The engineer who put the lights in and the timing of the lights, and I should write a letter to the city and about these lights. But so sitting in the car alone, you know, it's really obvious who's responsible. And so perhaps, you know, it's in a small situation like that, okay, you know, I'll lift my foot off the gas pedal and, you know, have the clutch in the gas pedal at the same time, ready to go as soon as the, you know, light turns, you know, there's no need for that. Let go. So those silly examples maybe, but the idea I'm trying to give you is that I bet there's lots of circumstances in your daily life where you're doing something that you can put under the description of the Four Noble Truths. You suffer, you see that you're holding on to something or resisting something or doing something that only you can do something about, and you let go of it. And in small things, like standing at the red light, maybe it's relatively easy. But then there are big things in life where it's not so easy to do that. And so Buddhist practice, the Eightfold Path, which is the fourth step of the Four Noble Truths, is designed to help us with the big things. Help us when it's not easy. Help us in the, you know, there's you know, it's a big deal to be a human being. It's very hard to be a human being. I take it as for granted that most people have tremendous challenges to get through their lives and figure out how to live their lives and all the different, you know, deaths and sicknesses and old age and relatives and all the different things that neglect work. It's a challenging thing. And how do we get through it? How do we get through it without suffering? How do we not only get through it without suffering, but can we not only not suffer, but can we somehow also, in our addressing of suffering, address not only our own, but also help the world around us in the process? And I really hope that Buddhist practice is not only stress reduction, but rather is addressing some of the deepest existential issues that everyone has to face. And one of the deepest, you know, so the issues are like death. How are you in relationship to dying? You know, the issue of identity. Well, how are you? What's your identity? Well, how much do you hold on to self-identity, self-image, self-representation? The issue of how we live in the world, how we live in relation to other people. These are really important issues for all of us to face. And so what the Buddhist contribution to these issues, one of the core ones, is to suggest that you're protected. It helps, it supports. If you study all these issues through the vantage point of the Four Noble Truths. And one of the interesting areas, to give you an example of how this can be interesting, sometimes people come to me and ask me something like, what's the meaning of life? And that's a big question, right? And it seems, some people ask the question with great sincerity. Seems like a certainly a sincere and meaningful question to ask, and to find your way in this life and to do something that's meaningful. And, what I find the most interesting way of responding, most useful way of responding, is to not answer the question, not to give them the meaning of life, but rather to ask them what prompted the question. Where does the question come from? And because if it's just an abstract, nice philosophy question, then I probably send them to philosophy class. But generally, it's not just kind of a general question, philosophical question, but rather it comes from some real something inside. And it's not, for some people, it comes, one of the things that prompts that question is fear. And fear is part of the source that the question comes out of. And anxiety. And it's a whole different animal, a whole different event, if you address the fear rather than address the question of meaning of life. In fact, if I gave them a brilliant answer about the meaning of life they can carry with them in their pockets and refer to whenever they needed it, I'd probably do them a great disservice. Because it doesn't address what's more deeply involved. So if you look at the question, what's the meaning of life, through the vantage point of the Four Noble Truths, where is the suffering in this question? Is there suffering connected to this question? And if there is, what's the origin or source of that suffering? What am I clinging to? What am I afraid of? And then if there is something that you're clinging to or afraid of, what happens if you meet it directly, if you're present for it and explore it? Is there something there that you can let go of? And if there is, in fact, something you can let go of that's behind the question of meaning, if you're able to let go of it, you still might have the question, what's the meaning of life? But now, there's no compulsion connected to the question. There's no emotional need connected to getting an answer. It's an interesting question, maybe a very important question still, but we're not caught in the grip of that question. I've had similar things where people ask, someone in Redwood City will raise their hand and ask something like, what does Buddhism teach about rebirth? So, okay, great. Now I have a PhD in Buddhism. I'll give a dissertation about, all the detailed teachings Buddhism has about rebirth and how it works and where you go and this and that. And the person begins glazing over, and, and their head drops down, and, it's that wasn't what they're asking. So what I've learned to do is not to answer the question directly, those kinds of questions, but rather to ask, oh, why are you asking? And almost inevitably, the answer is something like, someone I know just died. And they don't really want the answer to rebirth, Buddhist view. They're trying to cope and deal and address their suffering. And so by asking, why do you ask? It's like getting a chance to find out how are the Four Noble Truths playing themselves out in this person's life. And once they start saying, "Oh, someone died," then maybe we can get into something deeper and closer and more intimate, more important. What's going on? And if it's addressed at that level, most people that I've talked to, turns out they're not really that interested in the rebirth question. They're much more interested in somehow addressing and meeting their feelings they have around the loss they have. So the Four Noble Truths are not just meant for supermarket lines or red lights, but they're meant for these the deepest kind of areas of our life that are not easy to address, not easy to get under the surface of and be present for. And so there's a few things that help, and the Buddha organized those in a tidy way into what he called the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path are eight practices, or eight areas of practice, that support our ability to look deeply at the first three Noble Truths. Our ability to look deeply at our suffering, the origins of it, and our ability to let go. It sets good conditions in place so that we can do the inner work that takes to do this well, this path. And so the first two steps of the Eightfold Path have to do with understanding well what this is all about. So it has to do with understanding. So the first step has to do with understanding the Four Noble Truths and the value of them and how to use them and apply this framework of the Four Noble Truths in our lives. How to stop for suffering. Why it's useful to stop for suffering. And we stop for suffering, how to relate to it, how to look at it, what to look for. The second understanding has a little bit to do with understanding what attitudes are helpful along the path. Most endeavors people do require some kind of attitude, a little bit. You know, you go to a wedding, you usually adopt a certain kind of attitude that's appropriate. You walk into a little kindergarten classroom, especially when the kids are napping, nursery school. As an adult, you better adopt a certain attitude. If you go to a funeral, you don't whistle Dixie. You know, usually kind of in different jobs, different situations, you have different attitudes that are not because it's, you know, right or wrong, because they're supportive of the situation you're in. They're appropriate for the situation you're in. And so if you want to walk the path to freedom from freedom from clinging, it helps if you seize and desist from those behaviors, those dramatic behaviors that involve clinging. And the tradition says that the three most dramatic things that involve clinging are lust, ill will, and cruelty. So those three, if you're involved with those things, then you're practicing in a way that is not supportive of walking the path. It's just kind of like you're going in the wrong direction. If you want to head north, it doesn't help too much to go south unless you want to go for a long way. So, and then conversely, it helps to adopt certain attitudes or intentions, approaches the best you can, as sincerely as you can, as with as much integrity as you can, that are really come out of express a heart and a mind which doesn't cling. And so it says that loving kindness and compassion are ways, approaches in life which come really express non-clinging. A heart that doesn't cling will have loving kindness and compassion. The third one, the attitudes, is not very popular. It's renunciation. But you can kind of understand that if what we're renouncing is not the things of the world, but are clinging to them, there's no path to freedom without some renunciation, some willing to let go, not hold on so much. And then the next three steps of the Eightfold Path have to do with how we're living our lives. And it's very meaningful to me that these next three steps have to do completely about our relationship to the world around us and to other people. If people say that, you know, as Buddhists are just sitting looking at their navels and they're not connected to the world and path is, you know, a selfish path, you just point them to the middle steps of the Eightfold Path. Because it's all about developing healthy relationships to the world. And even the second step, this right intention, having compassion and loving kindness, is also about being in relationship to others. And so first it's the right speech, So it's important to be mindful of how you speak, to pay attention to it, to notice the impact it has, to notice what you're saying and what you're doing. Not just avoiding lying, but also avoiding divisive speech, avoiding speech that's slanderous and hurts people. And so to pay attention to our speech. Not so much because it's not because it's a moral thing that thou shalt speak right, but rather that if what you want to do is to be free spiritually, to be free of clinging, it doesn't make sense to be talking in ways that express clinging, holding on. And right speech has a lot to do with expressing non-clinging or expressing compassion or loving kindness for the world around us. That's supportive of this path. It helps it along the way. And then the next one is right action. It's living ethically. So there are actions we don't kill or steal or engage in sexual misconduct or lie. And then the right livelihood. So to whatever way that's kind of the basic way in which we live our lives, that way of living our lives, whether it's work or other ways that are a person's life, that it doesn't cause harm in the world. So care is given that we live a life that doesn't cause harm. So these are kind of at the foundation. These great, you don't have to do this, of course. There's no obligation to do this. But if what you want to do is this profound work of freeing the heart, it really helps if you set the conditions in place that supports that. And these are some of the conditions that support that. And then there's right effort, which is basically, very simply, means do the things which are helpful and avoid the things which don't help. Primarily, they refer to doing those things in the mind. Start being mindful of what goes on in your mind. And when you are impatient at the traffic light, that's not helpful. Let go. When you are relaxed at the traffic light, maybe that's helpful. So keep that going. So do the things which are helpful and avoid the things which are not helpful. And then there's right mindfulness, paying careful attention to what's going on. It's usually defined by the four foundations of mindfulness, basing our life, having these as the foundations of our life. And then finally, there's right concentration. And the concentration factor of the Eightfold Path is very helpful because to really be able to see deeply into the mind, to really be able to address the ways in which we cling and the mind is stuck, it helps to have a concentrated mind for a number of reasons. A concentrated mind is a soft mind. And a soft, malleable mind is a mind that's a lot easier to work with. You can let go easier because you're not frozen. So part of the function of concentration is to soften the mind. Make it really soft and light. The other thing about concentration is it helps make the mind really still and quiet so that it can begin, and you know, all the surface chatter of the mind falls away. All the hindrances fall away. And so there's very little obstructions anymore from seeing the subtlety of what goes on in the mind. And the subtlety is not consequential. Usually the subtle aspects of the mind are the most consequential, so where the kind of root assumptions and clingings we have. And so a concentrated mind helps us to see more clearly. It's a concentrated mind that can really see powerfully the Four Noble Truths. So we develop a quiet, focused, steady mind. It's very, very helpful. And the combination of mindfulness and concentration together is part of a very important part of this path here. But once you start talking about doing mindfulness practice and concentration practice, there can be a lot of attachment. And with attachment comes suffering. And so this is again, the Four Noble Truths are very important. Notice, be sensitive, keep it close at hand, like keep it on your left shoulder, the Four Noble Truths. Always ready. How are things right now? And is there any stress? Is there any suffering? Is there any angst? Is there any strain? And if there is, take a closer look. Is it necessary to strain? Is it necessary to hold on? What are you holding on to? Are you clinging? And if you're clinging to something, would it be okay to let go? If what you want to do is get concentrated, generally it helps a lot. Some people describe the process of concentration as a process of ever deepening letting go. Letting go, letting go, letting go. So as we come to the end of this retreat, we end on this topic of the Eightfold Path. And it's an appropriate way of ending a retreat because it offers to you something you can take with you, a way that you can continue practicing when you leave here. Mindfulness will come and go. There are times when it will be strong and times it will be weak, times you'll remember and to do it and times you'll not remember. Times that you do it consistently a lot and probably times you don't do it so consistently. But you certainly can't hold on to the experiences you had at the retreat. Try to go back and be as settled as you are here. It's not possible. But you can bring with you the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path fits into your luggage really well because it doesn't take up any space, doesn't have any weight, doesn't really have any location. The Eightfold Path only exists in walking it. You won't find the Eightfold Path at IRC, you won't find it at IMC, you won't find it at Spirit Rock, you won't find it at Zen Center. None of those places has the Eightfold Path. You'll only find it in how you walk, in your engagement of it. It only exists in your living it. So if you're one of the ways to integrate or continue or develop what you did here in the retreat is to consider if there are meaningful ways that you can engage or pick up or be involved in the different steps of the Eightfold Path. And one of the nice things to do if you haven't done this is to spend some time exploring each step of the Eightfold Path separately, like a week or a month or something, and reading about it, thinking about it, talking to friends about it, and really trying to get underneath this, what is this really all about? How does this work? And more importantly, how does it apply to me? And then go on to the next one. How does it apply to me? Once you understand it. And then, hopefully, the Four Noble Truths will not only be, something that ordinary, and ordinary issues of your life, but something that you'll learn to address in some of the most important areas of life. So that in all areas of your life, you can be a person who can be at peace. You can be a person who is not caught up. A person who's then available. And if you remember at the beginning of the retreat, I did the analogy of the fist that was closed. A fist is useful sometimes, but it's not as useful as an open hand. And so if we can, the whole path of mindfulness, the Four Noble Truths, all this is meant to help us to release the fist in our hearts, fist in our minds. And then we become much more useful. The hearts and minds become something we can bring. It can be gifts that we bring to the world and support others with that openness. May it be that our practice supports us to be open-handed, open-minded, and open-hearted as we go into the world and meet our communities. So let's take a couple of minutes to gather together, settle in.